It's the Smart Driving Cars Podcast, your source for the latest on self-driving, driverless, and smart transportation technology. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with the Faculty Chair of Autonomous Vehicle Engineering at Princeton University, Alan Kornhauser. Good to talk to you again, Alan.
It's great. I had a nice two-week vacation. We still did the podcast last week, and we're doing this one, so it goes forward.
Absolutely. Well, there are questions being raised about the future of the self-driving car unit at Uber. According to the information.com website, Uber has been spending as much as $200 million per quarter over the last year and a half or so on that unit. And there's some pressure, as you can imagine, from investors.
I guess there is. There should be pressure on them getting the work done. But they're between, as I like to say, a rock and a hard place. I think they have to be in it to win it, because if they don't win this, then one really has to question what is the ultimate or the growth strategy for Uber. Having chauffeured services obtained by an app is a great business, but it doesn't really scale. That business is in enormous jeopardy if now there's a competition in which you can offer the same service without needing a human chauffeur. And the competitive advantage that you have at that point are really two important competitive advantages. One is a competitive advantage on price, because, of course, a major component of the cost element of this is the labor cost of the driver. But the other big component is on the ability to perform. And so if your ability to perform is not dependent on an algorithm that does the management and distribution and deployment and utilization of vehicles that are commanded by computers, that's almost a trivial operation. And a very inexpensive operation to do, as opposed to marshaling individuals to provide the service at the places where it's needed, at the times where it's needed. So the advantage of automation in this business has two fundamentally important elements to it. One has to do with just fundamental cost, and the other has to do with the ability to perform. And so, in a sense, Uber is a very valuable product because of its customers that it has out there and its customer presence. That number of customers is really limited if you have to continue delivering that with human operators and a human in the loop. Whereas if one's doing it with basically with algorithms, it is an enormously strong competitor. So you're going to get your butt kicked. So in a sense, Uber has to be in this business. And the other element of it is that, well, you can always make or buy. But in this situation, I'm not sure that you really do have a make or buy opportunity, because if you don't make it, you're really going to have to pay for it when you buy it, because what you're buying is a production machine, something that is printing money. And if you're buying a machine that prints money, then you're going to have to pay for not what it costs to produce the machine, but for the money it produces if you don't produce it yourself. So therefore, in this business, I think that you don't really have the maker, the fundamental make or buy opportunity. You really have to make it. And he or she that makes it is then going to put it in production and capture the benefits by using it. And so, you know, they have to be in it. I don't know who would sell it to them at a cost price or a cost plus markup or cost plus margin. Waymo won't, because they're setting themselves up to operate. And we'll talk about Ford in a minute. You know, Ford doesn't look like, in terms of all their discussion, they're not only talking about making it, they're talking about, again, using it and using it as a productive machine, as a cash generator. So they aren't going to sell it or to Uber. And General Motors, again, in what they put out there, it doesn't look like they'll be in the, say, sell it to Uber and let them make money off of it. So in a sense, they're stuck. They're stuck that they have to make it. Otherwise, I don't know, they don't have a very bright future.
What you're saying is that it doesn't look like there are many opportunities for partnerships for them.
I don't think there are. I don't think there are. I don't see it. Maybe somebody else sees it. Maybe they see it. But if I have an entity that basically generates cash, I'm only going to sell it or partner with somebody if they give me the equivalent in the cash that it would generate. And so if you have to pay that much for it, what's your, you know, value add to the process? There isn't any. The value add you might look to Uber is say, well, they have, they're operating in these cities. They have some customers, but the some customers is just at the beginning of this. You know, they have, you know, 1% of the people out there. They don't have 10-15%, or, you know, a substantially large percentage. And in the places where they've gone in and established the market, they haven't made a lot of friends. So you wonder, my goodness, somebody might be just willing to let somebody else come in there and operate, especially if now you can. You can both operate it at a more affordable price and provide better and more reliable service. And if you can do that, then my goodness, you just crush the competition.
Well, you mentioned Ford, and they have a goal of developing a self-driving vehicle to deploy widely by 2021. The CEO of that effort has sent a report to the Department of Transportation and titled it A Matter of Trust. What are some of the takeaways you got from that letter, Alan?
Well, you know, the Ford and where they seem to be headed and what their public pronouncements have been really to do driverless. I mean, they call it self-driving. In our terminology, we call this driverless. This is to put vehicles out there that provide mobility. And that are able to provide mobility to you, Fred, and get you to where you're going, and then be able to go without a driver from after they drop you off to come pick me up. And so that's the real fundamental mobility benefit of driverless. And in their report, I mean, to give them credit, they realize, as we've said here many times, Fred, that safety is paramount. This has to, whoever's playing in this has to do it safely. Uber over the past year reminded us how just having one safety screw up just completely discombobulates you. I mean, it almost puts you out of business. So safety is absolutely paramount. And I think in terms of my own personal view, Once you have the algorithm such that they are safe, they're not the ones that are causing the crashes. They're not the ones that are at fault. They're not the ones that came up short. Once you have them doing that, then in fact, they are safe. Now, still, somebody can go and T-bone you and physics doesn't help you and it came out of nowhere, but that's their fault. You're still safe, at least in my definition of safe. So once you establish this, then in some sense, gangbusters out here, then you can do almost anything within the confines of the scenario where you've established this safety. And so having Ford out there, really putting out there what is a public-facing document, emphasizing safety, I think they deserve a lot of credit. They also deserve an enormous amount of credit in what they put out there is because they meticulously described a lot of elements that go around safety, including cybersecurity and so on. And so that's very good. But as with most things, nothing's perfect. To me, their real shortcoming is that while they are, and I should say the other important element that they put in there is their view that they're not going to sell this to consumers. This is not a vehicle that you and I normal people are going to buy. This is a vehicle that is going to be purchased by a fleet who's going to use then that this productive asset, as we were talking about with respect to Uber, to really produce mobility. And that's the real value of this asset. It improves the quality of life for many people, not just its owner. And I think their focus on that is spot on, and I applaud them on that. The shortcoming is, as I read it, I don't see that they see using this in a shared ride concept, or when the shared ride opportunity exists, really make this a real productive machine, so that in fact, just offering you a ride, it offers us both you and me arrive at the same time, because we happen to be going from about the same place to about the same place at about the same time. They haven't gotten sort of this public mobility, public transit concept of this. And it's kind of a shame, because there are opportunities, certainly in so-called peak hour, peak direction, where there's congestion. Why is there congestion? Because a lot of people want to go from about the same place to about the same place at about the same time. And it doesn't mean that you're going to not put a lot of people in each vehicle. Probably just put two or three. And if you do two or threes in the peak hour, then basically that solves congestion, that solves energy, that solves pollution, and that really improves affordability without really substantially detracting from the level of service that's being offered, except for the fact that you don't happen to be riding alone. So I guess, what do? When you ride alone, you pick your nose, and you don't see anybody else pick your nose. I don't know why you want to ride alone so much. But anyway, it's the automobile business for the last 100-plus years has been selling this. You can have this mobility to be able to be alone and travel alone. That's how they sold cars, and they can't seem to get away from that one. So, but short of that, short of the focus on really providing mobility to everyone and providing it efficiently and really affordably, and taking advantage of the opportunities that exist in higher demand congested corridors, origins, destinations, however we want to call them. Except for that, I think it's a really good report.
I guess the message there is rides should be shared. Don't be picky.
Right. And don't be selfish. My goodness. I mean, going about the same place, probably has something in common. You can afford to say hi, you know, how are you? And then, you know, bury your face in your phone. I mean, whatever. you'll have the privacy that way. It continues to surprise me how the automobile OEMs just haven't gotten that piece of it. But maybe I'm just the weird guy that is just too focused on that. It's with respect to the ride sharing that we get the really public benefits out of this. You get the public benefits out of sharing energy, sharing pollution, sharing capacity on a roadway, and as opposed to selfishly using the energy, the pollution, and the capacity. And I think that is an enormously valuable public spirit in this, and we should promote it.
Well, another company that you focus on in the latest newsletter is Tesla. There's a lawsuit and SEC investigation now following Elon Musk's tweet about wanting to take the company private.
Well, you know, poor Elon. I mean, he's been working so hard, and he's been saying that he's been doing 110, 120 hour weeks. And at least from all the public promotion that he puts out, he must be doing 110, 120 hour weeks. And so maybe he went a little bit too far with one of his tweets. I mean, you know, it's certainly when he puts a potential price out there of $420 and sort of implies that, somebody is really is serious about paying that. I think that, the SEC wants to make sure that that's not just pumping and dumping. And of course, the short sellers are out there. They're scared to death because who knows what if the price goes up to 420? I mean, they've got their short bets are pretty bad bets, and they're sitting out there. Especially, you know, if you're playing the shorts, at some point you just have to come up with cash to buy it at those prices, and that can be extremely difficult if you haven't made the bet in the right direction. So you can imagine all the short sellers out there lining up, and as soon as he makes some pronouncement like that, ready to go after him. So poor Elon. He's a great promoter. He's a great visionary. It's amazing what he's been able to accomplish.
And this weekend, he's talking about trying to get an entry-level Tesla down to $25,000 or so.
Sure, of course. I mean, yeah, why not get it down to $2,500? I mean, you know, why just stop at $25,000? To have the visions and to push for those visions are appropriate. I think that once you put a number down on a stock price, things get a little bit dicier. But yes, and he's building tunnels, and he's doing hyperloops, and my goodness, as I think I've mentioned in the podcast before, his vision of how to go to Mars is certainly the best one that I've heard in 50 years. And so, and at one time, I was all wound up and part of those who wanted to go to Mars in the late 60s. But certainly, his vision of how to accomplish that is really intriguing, and might also have some amount of credibility. So go for it, Elon.
Yeah, you mentioned the tunnel. He announced plans at his boring company. And I love the name of that, announced plans to build a 3-mile tunnel that could transport passengers in Los Angeles to Dodger Stadium in 4 minutes using this transportation system and I guess what amounts to cars that are being likened to electric skates that can hold between 8 and 16 people. So and he's saying it can be done pretty quickly. So I guess
whatever. I mean, to solve a point A to point B problem is whatever. It's always one specific problem. Is it generalizable to solve a substantial amount of mobility? No, unfortunately. So in a specific instance, maybe. I don't know what the geology is in that corridor between those two. I mean, maybe you can just get a bunch of moles who can dig the tunnel with their teeth. And I think that's the way moles dig tunnels. Maybe that's not correct. I believe myself. But sure, if the geology is right, bore a tunnel. Hopefully there aren't a bunch of utilities and so on underground that you have to do. If this boring company is so good, I just wish they would come to Princeton and bore some tunnels so we could get rid of the overhead wire. So every winter when there's an ice storm brings down some trees, it doesn't bring down the wire. So go for it. But digging tunnels, I don't know. That's always been a potential solution. It's just that it ends up being having some details associated with it, which are tough. I mean, what I love about the driverless car is the opportunity to really focus on the let's call it the artificial intelligence that goes into safe driving. And make that work on a single vehicle, because if you can make it work on a single vehicle, the reproduction cost of that technology is essentially zero. You can copy the software for essentially zero, and the hardware that you use, you realize most of it is Moore's Law-ish, and therefore it scales well. And you can expect the cost of those components to come way down. And so therefore, you can, by focusing on the one, you can solve the many problem. Focusing on the one of boring a tunnel from point A to point B in LA, I don't think generalizes. It's doable maybe just because of the specific geology that happens to be under there. But all of a sudden you put that somewhere else, and then you have to worry about whether or not you're crossing who knows what geodetic line and so on, and earthquakes and whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, the earthquakes come to mind.
I wish you luck, but it's not my bailiwick.
The 2025AD.com site has an interesting piece titled "Which car makers will survive the new mobility?" It talks about a bunch of things, including the end of car makers as we know them. And we've been talking about Ford a little bit. The author of this is Alex Roy, who we got to hear from at the Princeton Smart Driving Car Summit last spring.
Yeah, I think Alex put together a very nice article here, and I think it's there's a lot of food for thought in there. Focusing on mobility for many is a different market for the automobile companies, and so it is disruptive. And unless there is substantial change in the basic philosophies, it will be tough for them. So that's why you see Ford basically setting up a separate unit focused on that to allow, as I think I've written before, the legacy unit focusing on F-Ford 150 so that we can haul stuff, and letting this other unit go after this new mobility market. And that new mobility market that Adam Jonas has been talking about for years now is, this $10 trillion a year market. That is really agnostic in terms of what is providing it, as long as the mobility is being provided at an affordable price, sets itself up for enormous disruption. So you can see how Alex then develops this and say, my goodness, the legacy automaker of basically selling you a vehicle in a dealership that you end up owning, being responsible for, not only its maintenance, but its liability. In a sense, if anything goes wrong, it's your fault. Say, oh my goodness, my mobility is going to be provided by this entity who's going to accept all that responsibility. And in fact, it's going to have done its work so well and dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's to make it safe is a completely different business. So, you know, it's as different from Blockbuster to Netflix. You know, it's one of those changes, or, you know, from film to a CCD chip. These are really disruptive. You know, from a dialing phone to an iPhone. That's why there's so much money and so much interest, and that's why Fred, you and I do the podcast. This is the beginning of what may very well be an enormously disruptive industry. And some automakers are going to fall by the wayside, if not all of them.
Interesting. And then there's a piece in Bloomberg worth chatting about, quoting a well-known machine learning researcher as saying the way to get self-driving cars on the streets sooner is to teach pedestrians to behave less erratically.
Well, sure, of course. That would be easy. There's some amount of practicality in that. As I point out in smart driving cars, if we look at how pedestrians behave in a horse and buggy era, pedestrians today are behaving substantially differently in the conventional automobile era. And there are elements of the conventional automobile era that don't even permit pedestrians. Interstate highways, for example. And as I point out in smart driving cars, out here on Route 1, you know, they put up a fence on top of the New Jersey barrier that separates the north from the southbound lanes. To make sure that pedestrians don't go running from the tire store to the McDonald's on the other side of the road, because otherwise their chances of making it across there without getting crushed is essentially zero. So we've done things to basically force pedestrians to behave or to establish rules of the road, not only for the conventional automobile, but also for bicyclists, for motorcyclists, for trucks, and for pedestrians. And as we go to a driverless world where vehicles will not necessarily have anybody in them, we will have to adjust. And in a sense, how we get people to adjust, hopefully they will realize that it's in their best interest to adjust. Or some people are probably going to get hurt. And you won't be able to just jump out in front of a driverless vehicle and not get crushed, because there are laws of physics and you know, Newton's not going away, and so you'll get run over. So you want to behave that way, behave that way. You can behave that way now. You go out in Route 1, jump in front of a car. Okay, you die. Great. What have you proven? So I think there's going to be a certain amount of education that's going to go on. And there's going to be a negotiation, and we're going to evolve so that people behave. But again, having everybody behave is an objective here. Everybody won't. And so because everybody won't, some people will get hurt, and we'll have to be able to deal with it. that's life. That's what being human is all about, unfortunately or fortunately.
The public, though, doesn't seem to deal with accidents that are caused by an autonomous vehicle the same way they would as if there was a driver behind the wheel.
Well, maybe not, and of course they don't, and of course the Uber crash in Arizona teaches us that I think from what I know of it that if that had not been an automated vehicle, that it would have been a normal vehicle with a normal driver paying attention driving down that road. Unfortunately, Elaine Herzberg probably there would still been the crash, I think. The lighting and so on, at least from the information that's been put out to the public, to me, without looking at it in great detail, seemed to have been such that that crash would have been unavoidable. And I think that was the original police report reaction to it. Considering that it would have been a conventional vehicle, but it wasn't a conventional vehicle. And this vehicle had sensors on it that are better than us. And in fact, it saw her 6 seconds before it hit her. And so therefore in that these systems are in fact better than us. And so they should be able to avoid, they'll need to avoid many of the crashes that otherwise we wouldn't have avoided. And that's their value. In the crashes that still occur, then they better have done all they can do, a substantial amount of what they can do to avoid that crash. The failure in the Arizona case was that Uber had turned off the automated emergency braking system that would have, by all accounts, and even Volvo, I think, has come out, or not Volvo, who was it last week that came out and said it? I forgot who it was. Come on, said that they would have stopped. Or IIHS came out after their testing of the Volvo automated emergency braking system. David Zuby came out, I think, or at least was quoted as saying that that system would have stopped. And so that is a failure of the design. But let's fix that. Let's not turn off the automated emergency braking system. And let's make the automated emergency braking system not have false alarms, or maybe have such rare false alarm. And when it does have a false alarm, it doesn't just slam on the brakes and then get rear-ended by everybody. Does it in a graceful way such that, it continues to survey the situation and at some point says, oh, my goodness, that was a false alarm. Let me take my foot off the brake and hit the gas. And so if one does that, then in fact, these systems are enormously safe. If somebody jumps out in front of it and the brakes are applied and it still smashes into them and unfortunately causes, a crash, then that's not their fault. That's not the fault of the system. That's the fault of the person or the entity that jumped out in front. And so then they should be given a pass. I drove from Maine to Princeton this morning, got up at 3:30 in the morning, left at 4:00. And out there on the roads of Maine, I was basically in a two-lane roads driving down the middle of the road. There's nobody coming the other way. Why? Because I wanted to give myself as much time in case a deer jumped out from one side or the other, so that I'd have an equal opportunity to try to see him soon enough or her soon enough to slam on the brakes. But in situations that the deer jumps out in front of you, You slam on the brakes. Newton says, oh, sorry, don't have enough friction force to keep you from hitting it, and you hit it. But, you know, that stuff happens, and we need to move on.
Well, finally, Alan, the news that Kroger is testing driverless cars for grocery deliveries in a Phoenix suburb. That sounds familiar. I guess the problem here is the driverless vehicle they're talking about has two people in the front seat.
Right. It was like when Uber went out in Pittsburgh with driverless vehicles and they had two people in it. I think it's fine to go out and collect some data and do that and to actually do the interaction with the people that's making it happen. But in a sense, to do it in a vehicle that has all the sensors on it, fine. I don't know. I don't know that it moves the ball all that much. It's nice promotional material. It's nice, eye candy. It puts Kroger in there and gives them good, public relations and so on. But I think it doesn't. I'm happy for them. What will be the real test is when, as Waymo has done in Phoenix, when they take those people out of the car and have that delivery made to the home and without anybody in the vehicle. And as we've also discussed here in the podcast, I think there's a great opportunity to do goods delivery to homes from sources like the grocery store, hardware store, or whatever, or a Amazon warehouse. But to do that in the middle of the night, at 4 o'clock this morning, driving on main roads, there's nobody else out there. The infrastructure is unused. And to then utilize it at that time to do goods movement is an enormous opportunity. Why don't we do more of it? Probably until about 5 o'clock in the morning, the most vehicles that encountered were trucks with truck drivers out there. Why? Because those that can do it at that time do it. Because then they don't have to deal with the congestion of all the other cars out there. But it's kind of tough getting people to work the night shift and so on and so forth, and it's not the best quality of life for the workers. But if these are driverless vehicles, guess what? The algorithm doesn't care what time of the day it is. And so it can be out there doing it. And I think it's just a great opportunity that exists. And then we'll see if it happens. I think Kroger maybe should try it so that they have your fresh milk and your berries and your cereal right there on your front porch as you get up in the morning. I mean, it'll be like living in Brooklyn in the 19th century, horse car delivery folks were out there, in the early morning, putting fresh milk on your doorstep. In the metal box that was insulated. And so now we'll have an insulated Amazon box or something. I don't know. That will do it. That's where the great opportunity is. I think that we'll see how it evolves.
Now, they're saying their intent is to remove the humans from the vehicles sometime this fall. People, by the way, customers are going to be charged $6 for the grocery deliveries.
That's awfully inexpensive. And geez, if you bring me my stuff for $6, then, I guess I'll do it. Great.
Well, on that note, it is time to bag this edition of the podcast. You can find us at smartdrivingcar.com, on iTunes, Google Play, and more, even on your Amazon Alexa. Look for my tech reports at techstination.com. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with Alan Kornhauser. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
Have a great remaining 2 weeks of summer.